I did a project on my mother's house because it was unchanged from the 1930s. That amazed me, that something could stay so as it was. My father did all the decorations of it, and after he died it became very precious to me because the house then sort of embodied his creativity. And then as my mother got older and I was looking after her, I didn't live with her, but I commuted backwards and forwards to look after her. Making images of the house became part of that because it was a way for me to continue my creative practice. And after she died, I had to empty the house. So I was very interested in the way that objects still keep an emotional life after the death of a person, and this whole way in which we invest objects with an emotional life became very pertinent to me. And I think that may be a generational thing. It is partly to do with that thing about the death of one's parent or the death of somebody significant. But there is a stage you go through. I mean, you know, Freud's famous essay, Mourning and Melancholia, about how you let go of the grief of the loss.
Or you don't.
Or you don't. Well, you hypercathect from every object. Every object has this incredible power at a certain stage. And then you sort of release it, or you don't, indeed. And I'm very interested in how we mediate or investigate this process of objects having power and changing their power, and how we keep their power or not, which is why I was very excited by your presentation.
But most of the things in there don't belong to people that have died. They've been
donated. Yeah.
They've been collected. They were collected. A lot of them by the founder. A lot of them are. They get a lot of things sent. And the guy that runs the place, he was saying that he thinks it's because people recognise that these objects might have some kind of power, but they don't know what to do with them, and they feel they can't just throw them away.
Yeah.
But actually, what you were talking about made me think, not of that, but of another museum I'm working on, which is this tiny place up in Burnley called the British in India Museum. And everything in there was a donation. There was nothing that was bought.
Right.
And I started looking through some of the records and the visitors' books, and one of the things that's quite clear is that a lot of people have given things that belong to their parents. And it struck me that this museum was like a holding ground for the thing, not even that, but it was more like the things that are very precious, sentimentally or financially, you keep for yourself. Mm. The things that are just you deem to be unconnected or trivial or worthless go.
Yeah.
But then there's a sort of hovering grey intermittent category of stuff. And it feels too close to the person to get. I mean, this is my. There is clearly something. There's clearly some kinds of things that people felt they couldn't just chop.
Yeah.
And they often get sent to museums.
Feels like still exist in some shape or form.
Well, they deserve archiving, is the question that I think the individuals have got. And then the question is, where do I archive it? I think that is a question that a lot of people
quite
have to face.
It's because they fall between two.
Yeah.
On the one hand, you know that they're meant enough to the person for you to feel a bit guilty about getting rid of them, but they don't quite get it into the category where you want to imbue it with the, that's my mother's ring, teacup, or whatever.
Is there an impressionistic category of object that you see?
The one that really struck me, I mean, there's lots of different things, but I think it is, I think you're right, it's the things that I suspect it's the things that you were important to the other person but weren't necessarily important to them. So in the same way that, you know, you wouldn't chuck your,
that hideous jade brooch that you always thought was disgusting.
There was quite a lot of, one of the things I always remember, there was a cat bed. So, I mean, in terms of like the imprint of the body, the woman that had given this camp bed wrote in the visitor's book about thinking that her father would be pleased about it being there. And as I looked through the visitor's books, all the different members of the family came to the museum. I mean, it is the back of beyond this place, to come and look at the camp bed in the museum. And I'm sure there's something there about actually just physicality of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Someone's body in this space.
Prone.
And other people too presumably would respond to that. Oh, not just the family.
God alone knows this place.
Oh, this
was
nowhere.
Stock underneath the display. You know, it's like the equivalent of where those blue boxes are.
It reminds me of the shadow on the Hiroshima Bridge. Do you know that shadow?
Yeah.
at the moment that the bomb went up, someone was walking across the bridge.
Oh, yes.
And what remains is...
Oh, yes.
They were blown into a shadow on the bridge. So in some sense, they're some of the DNA of that person, or some of the molecular presence of that person, or the issue around photography that actually you were in the same space and it's physically kind of somehow kind of takes in you. So it's like a kind of, these are objects like photographs, aren't they? They have that quality, the imprint of a presence on a bed, even by implication.
So this is probably a bit flippant given the conversation, but the Irish writer Flann O'Brien. Do you know the story about turning into a bicycle? That you write? No, it's basically it's kind of fantastical comedy, but people ride their bicycles all the time, and slowly they turn into bicycles, and the bicycles begin to turn into them, and they lean in curious ways, or the tendency to follow their owners home, or the attempt to leave them. And it's just about that thing about having total contact with something over long periods of time, just turning into. One becomes a bicycle.
Becoming,
your modern centaurs.
Yeah. And the bicycle would lean against. Yeah. But clearly, somewhere we do have some sense of people leaving, long physical contact, leaving readable traces.
Mm. Those readable traces, that's interesting. Both your discussions, this idea of sort of the. Almost sort of artifact, as it were. It's from outside that culture, saw one of these things as an object just laying around. I think it has this aura, this energy as such, where if it was just a potato or something, it doesn't have that same resonance. I don't know, does that make sense? It's got this weight about it, so you know, less disposable or something. It's got something about this tangible quality.
I think also I think they have a real desire for objects to mean something.
Yes, I was just context. Thinking that this.
You know that you want to take this object and it, you know, always look at it and feel that connection is still there, and in your heart you might think that it disappoints. It doesn't because it can't. But our desire is so strong. That's happened, that the residue, you know, that person's touched
it.
You want it so.
But also the disappointment
to create that
when it doesn't work.
Exactly.
Because, you know, it's probably for various reasons at some point sat there with photographs or shirts or belongings and trying to conjure somebody back.
And no longer works in inverted commas. Yeah, that's interesting.
We want there to be this other. This is not the same at all.
It's total bloody failure of being able to do it.
I know this is an aside, but we always wanted the family dog to acknowledge that my brother had died. And he didn't. You know, but we so wanted.
What kind of acknowledgement?
Oh, I don't know, lying in front of the bedroom door whimpering, or, you know, that's too many films, but, you know, the desire. But of course, his mother was just dead, you know, and the dog went on with the day, but we so wanted there to be something.
But animals do sometimes.
I know, that's what our duff dog, obviously.
Yeah.
He
swallows.
But it's only relative because the desire, the passion for things to mean, have meaning, have presence.
And the danger of objects having meaning, as it were, kind of absorbing from you, the kind of the power of your life, is why they say, just go and give away all your stuff.
They always do.
Give away your stuff, get rid of your stuff.
But also, I had a conversation with my mother. My mum talks about dying a lot, and has done since she was, both my parents do, and have done since they were both very young.
I'm very aware of it.
We recently decided my mum actually had to make a list of things which she considered to be really important in case we threw away the things that she thought was important, wasn't necessary.
What you thought, that's true.
I don't know that she's done it. But
that's
when you put a mind at rest in church, you do this, identify things.
My father always wants to come round to my house and leave a trace, build a bit of patio, put up something, really? You know, just so that I will remember him. He won't say that, but that's
not
what he wants. I won't let him do it.
Do you think it's not conscious or unconscious that then? Do you think it's absolutely conscious?
Absolutely conscious.
Oh, really?
You know, that he's stitching himself into my history.
Yeah.
And into my future.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Consciously. So,
That's interesting. Wow. So it's an active leaving for trade.
Yes, and I actively won't let him. So it's a very interesting battle.
Oh, that's very
but it is resistance of that, you know, that presence beyond the grave.
Yeah, like a physicality. Yeah,
and his desire for it, because he feels he'll be truly dead when there is none. That's about friends who had, I think they found in the attic of a house, a walking stick made out of a spine. A really spooky object, and they couldn't touch it. They physically couldn't touch it. They couldn't get rid of it either. It's very, so their relationship was so complex in that object, so contested, you know, because you think they'd either throw it away or give it away, but they felt a real physical revulsion about touching it, but they still had it. They still had it. Somehow it belonged to the house, and somehow it had a greater right or. You know, its place was here.
So the house becomes a possessor as well.
Yeah.
Wow. Is it a resistance to change or a wish to memorialise? Or I mean, I do think there are, I mean, people have such different attitudes to it. I know my friends were saying, you know, throw everything away, you know, do this. And I just couldn't do that. But I mean, people's responses to being left with too much stuff really vary. Some people will just sort of like call in the house clearance people and I don't know, maybe they're not even there, you know, and they come back to an empty place and like move on, as they say. And other people, like myself, will sift through it all. And other people just live in a museum. They kind of don't move out, like, you know, they just stay with it.
But that's it. Because that exposes another thing, that some people have a different propensity to desire objects.
Yes, okay. So
or maybe some people are not so sensitive to it. I'm a no object person.
Oh, right.
But I go into people's houses who are full of objects and I think, oh God, that's one. how lucky am I there? I could never have found that stuff.
Okay.
Is it different attachments to the past?
Yeah, that's what I was questioning, I suppose.
It's how you materialise the past, or whether or not you do want to materialise the past, and what the action of materialising the past can be. Because, I mean, you can take it two different ways, couldn't you? Because you could say, on the one hand, people hold on to all of this stuff because it represents to them the past and they're physically hanging on to it, but on the other hand it might be that it works like a monument or a memorial where somehow you can just get on with all your stuff because there are those bloody photo albums that sit underneath the desk and they just take care of it, or you know, or that suitcase in the loft,
it's somehow logged,
you know, somehow it's there.
So what do we fear about losing that then? So people run back into burning houses to save photographs.
Yes, that's the famous one. You know. Or hard drives now, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really.
But what is it we fear in losing those images?
Memory.
Yes, and what's that? But what is that?
What is that anyway?
The things we kind of define ourselves about, I guess. Anchors, maybe. Reflections, mirrors, somehow.
Yeah.
There was a love. The Curran Museum up at Bloomsbury, which was the foundling hospital.
Oh, yeah.
They got a museum display there in one of the side rooms. And their symbols, their kind of broken, broken kind of rings or medals are half of a coin. That when you come to redeem the child, you'll be recognised, or a piece of fabric.
Oh, right.
Cut
oh,
off.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yes, and so many of them, only half was there, never came back.
That is
heartbreaking.
The relationship to the emotional life of the object.
That's a brilliant example.
Yeah, it's interesting. What does it say?
Oh, it's a story, I suppose, for me. Because
those are objects about. They have these narratives, these objects, and they're only half the object, they're a symbol of the object. You know, literally, it's broken, it's fragments. So it's a fragment of an object.
So we go into the museum, we see a half, and then in another drawer, for some reason there's the two halves put back together, you know. So what would be the difference?
Then it would have been redeemed.
For
that
us,
would be the narrative.
Yes, I understand that, but yeah. For emotionally, yeah. For us, because as soon as we think of the half that's not redeemed, we think, child has left and nobody came. But
yes.
So
but it retains its emotional effect.
Yeah,
it does. It's still an unredeemed pledge for eternity.
Yes. And that's its power, isn't it?
That's its power.
Rather than the object, in a sense, because if the two halves are there, it's another exhibit.
Yeah,
that's somehow a completed story, isn't it? And it's our desire to...
Half an object.
It's heartrending, that one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Pledge. An unfulfilled pledge. It sort of sets you off on a quest too, wouldn't it? You think that if you picked it up, you'd have to go.
It's almost in limbo, isn't it? It's not complete or something. It's just exhibiting almost.
I didn't know that museum.
Amazing.
Yeah. Do you know where the Renoir, is it the Renoir Cinema?
Yeah,
it's opposite there.
Okay.
There's a museum down one side of
it's
that
green.
The Corum.
Corum.
Museum. Corum.
I'm definitely
coming
to
Corum
Field. Yeah. I mean, you can only go in if accompanied by a child.
You can go in the museum, but you can't go in the fields.
Yeah, but you can't go in the fields.
Yeah, that's right.
I know, I've got to find a child.
And you just snatch one off the face. Give them off a bus ticket to their parents.
Was there anything still in that question? What was the starting question?
Mediating, investigating the emotional life of objects after death of the owner. So the Founding Museum is a brilliant example of that, because as you say, it still keeps its emotional life because of the stories that we give to it, because it is this notion that the mother had to give up the child.
Stories that it had, they gave to it.
Oh, that they gave to it, but then we can, I suppose, if we've read our Dickens or our, you know, whatever, we've got enough narratives in circulation that we can begin to bring to bear on it, as well as our own life experiences.
It's also
because we don't know the actual story. Probably.
It's also because the objects in that case are so cheap.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Because the women that were giving things, it's like they had nothing.
Yeah.
So often it's just like a tiny little strip cut from a petticoat or a little bit of ribbon. So it's sort of, it's actually. Tiny nothingness.
Mm.
This stuff.
I've been tears already.
I'm going to use my feet.
Okay, sorry. Very, thanks for that interjection, though. Oh, blimey, yes.
Was there a category of objects that you didn't know what to do with when you were in the house?
Yes, definitely intermediate objects. And I think I brought too many back to my own place, but it was very much, I wish I could have found an archive to put them in. And I had friends.
This is an intermediate object.
Just about to ask.
You mean the ones I couldn't throw away and the ones that I don't. I mean, I usually wear my mum's rings. I'm not today, which is interesting.
But you see, that's not an intermediate object.
No, that's what I wear.
Object.
That's what I wear. That's what I meant. I usually wear it. So that was the precious one. Intermediate. Well, I kept one of my father's suits, but there were lots of suits. He was a tailor, so I couldn't keep them all. And I tried to, and I might donate one to a museum, but you know, it's like I wanted them to go somewhere.
Yeah.
I didn't want them to go in the rubbish.
Yeah.
So most of them I tried to give away to places like Oxfam.
Yeah.
So at least they were going to get reused. There were actually different levels. There was rubbish, there was reused. Then there was, didn't sell anything. Then there were the thing, intermediate ones I kept. And then there were the precious things. And then
what counts as intermediate?
Or did it even change?
So
it's changing. The point I was trying to make was that it's changing.
But more things are slipping into the intermediate.
Well, more things could probably go, but the problem is that I did feel that I wished them to go somewhere.
Yeah.
Like the suit. I mean, I'd like that to go somewhere rather than just be going in tip, because it's a, you know, my father was a tailor, they're handmade bespoke suits, they're really beautiful, and they belong to a period.
Mm.
You know, it's a long time ago now, there won't be many of them left, most people do throw them away. So it is partly my notion that I have a responsibility to archive.
Which is why the museums are so
precious. Oh, yeah, no, I'm such a...
forgiving, aren't they?
Yeah, but the thing is what a museum's going to do with them as well, you know, I mean...
They just swell and swell and swell.
You know, once something's been accessioned, it's the amount of work and labour and storage that's involved.
Yeah, but then the question is, what do we keep? You see, I got quite passionate about the notion that this was a working class family home that was going to be destroyed. And why doesn't the National Trust think that working class family homes are worth keeping? At least one per century. Why do we only keep...
There are in Wales, aren't they? There's a great... I'm sure there are others, but...
There aren't many, though, is my point. And I think Paul McCartney's family home has been kept, and that's the semi-D. Yeah. But the point I'm making, really, is that we see these things as so ordinary and everyday, except we're actually losing them.
Yeah.
Because they're being modernised, and, you know, the privet hedges are being dug up, and the windows are being, you know, double glazed with plastic. I mean, all these things are changing. We accept that as change, but then if you look back sort of like 100 years, that's what it's going to be soon. It won't be here. It won't be anything left of what we took for granted when I was a kid. And actually then that becomes a historical. You know, it's when we all become historical subjects. So when you go around one of those sort of everyday objects events, I think they happened at the Festival Hall once, and this little kid was going, oh, what's that? It's a record player. Oh, what's that? You know, all this stuff that was part of my life had become totally bizarre.
My dad
would
come to these museums and he just says, oh God, it's too much
like
stuff.
Home.
But that's another question, isn't it? Is it gendered too? But do women have a greater...
No, actually, it's something... All this... I mean, I've got... For this book, I'm asking about, apart from ones I used to go and see anyway, I've actually kind of I've been to over about 60 museums, small, independent museums, to actually go and look at them as research, rather than just having visited. And I've been to two that have been run by women.
Really?
Yeah. It's not disgraceful because most of the places set up by, you know, I mean, a lot of them are set up in like sheds at the bottom of the garden,
like
in a barn or in like a bit of an old converted building. I've been into places which is in this front room. It's some of them, like the Witchcraft Museum, are run more commercially, but even so, they're very small, you know.
So these are tiny
generous
museums,
But it's clearly something that. So actually, I don't think it's the thing about resources, because the resources are often so small that it's not to do with the kind of disparity of gendered income, I don't think. It's something else. It is gendered, but it's not.
But that's more about collecting, isn't it?
But you're not just collecting. You are turning it into a museum. You are opening hours.
It's interesting.
You're inviting people in.
You're interpreting it.
Yeah.
Digitalising it.
Actually.
Or not.
Usually not.
Okay. Not even bad stories or, you know, false stories.
No. It's just like, this is stuff. Here is stuff.
Here's some more stuff.
Please come and see.
Okay, stuff, yeah.
So I think I suspect it's...
So it's not mediated, it's stuff?
Yeah, it depends. Some of the stuff is sorted into basic categories. Some of it's labelled endlessly.
I love your research.
Some of it's... Well, you know, but most of it's barking in one respect or another. But I wonder whether it's something to do with... There seems to be something quite close to what do you do with things.
Yes.
It might not necessarily be about people dying, but it's what do you do with things that you care about in one respect or another.
That
and
no
often
one
what
might
happens
fit.
Is people start off as collectors, and then the stuff that they have and care about expands and expands and expands. Or maybe it's something else, I don't know. Maybe it's something to do with some people need to show that to other people and other people don't.
Yeah.
Maybe women are happy to box it all up and know that it's there, or put it on their shelves and just look at it themselves.
And it seems that a real, going back to your question, is the real power of the object is it belonged to this person who you cared about so much. So,
well, I suppose I was going to ask you more about whether it's an embodied thing or not.
But that's why I was going to ask you whether you would throw away, or what would happen, how would you feel if you lost the prime group, the group of things
I did. I lost my father's ring. I was wearing I was wearing my mother's rings and my father's rings on a chain around my neck, and I lost my father's ring. That was hard. but I put a thimble in its place.
So you can stand in the object, like an object can stand in for another thing.
That's very interesting.
But also, don't you think it's interesting that it was the ring and then it was the thimble? So again, it's still a hand thing. But the ring you wore in his life, sorry?
It wasn't his thimble. Yes, it was his thimble.
Oh, of course it was his thimble. He's a tailor.
Sorry, yes. Catch up, Jim.
So, yes, but I mean, of course it wasn't as good. But what do you do? You know, you've lost a really significant object. The wedding ring, the one he wore all his life from whenever, I don't know, 22, 84. I was terribly upset.
Yeah.
I lost it when I was on holidays. So I couldn't spend the whole trip being upset. So then I was like, oh, how do I deal with this? Oh, I use his thimble. So that's what I wear, my man's rings and his thimble.
But in a sense, you felt that you were losing a bit of him.
Yes.
And you had another bit of him.
Yeah. So substitution was the strategy.
So it was him that you were losing.
Well, I'd lost him already.
I know, but I mean, that's in the loss of the object.
But you have, yes, there's chains of losses, aren't there?
Yeah, there are.
And standings. Yeah,
I suppose that's what I'm interested in, the way that the object actually... Losing the object is a kind of rehearsal, it's a kind of endless rehearsal of the loss, really.
Yes.
And it's like, how do we deal with this endless rehearsal of loss?
Yes.
And which I suppose is life, you know.
Does it diminish? I wonder if it did, say you had to have a sequence of objects.
Yes.
Would there be a point where, you know, you rehearsed it so much that you know, you went through the process. So you lost the thimble and you put something else in and you slowly came to terms with that loss.
Oh yes, we do.
But there are other objects that, as you say, become less significant.
Much less, yeah.
You kept them because you needed to keep things in the beginning, but they've become less.
Yeah.
Imbued with that, so they've faded in a way.
Oh, they've faded a lot. Yeah, they really have. Interestingly,
but it almost had somebody that helped you through that process in the beginning. It probably might have been really, really powerful. And then its purpose.
They're transitional objects. They really are.
Yeah, but I'm trying to remember my Winnicott. Aren't transitional objects about detaching as a child, as a baby? Isn't that?
Yeah.
So it's about detaching from your mother's body as a baby.
To going out in the world. Yeah.
But then you use the same apparatus again when
to deal with loss.
Yeah.
They are transitional objects.
That's why they're so hard then.
And it's also why it doesn't matter if it's just a bit of a...
Which takes us back to the... Yeah, that's right. Well, that's why it doesn't matter if it's just a thimble. It's just an ordinary metal thimble that says made in England. I'm not wearing it.
But the thing you're wearing around the neck is something that's an attractive thing. You know, I'd imagine the little group of rings and... You wouldn't be wearing the little bit of string.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe you would.
I mean, parents keep all sorts of odd, so I'm told, odd things of their children. Teeth and things.
Yeah.
Hair. Bits of
hair. That's true.
That's quite...
I think I might even have a little bit of umbilical cord somewhere.
Oh, wow.
You also have your child.
My child.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So how do you feel about those?
The umbilical cord, or the little... Well, it just looks like a scab now. It's not a
good... And you still keep it?
One of those, it's in a box up there. I know it's there, and that's in
there.
And every now and again, my mind can go visit, and that's fine.
But it's still significant.
It's amazing. Amazing thing to keep.
My dad kept all of his children.
All of his children.
Teeth from each child, maybe. Mm.
Because
there
were four of them.
Oh, wow.
Because
what's happened to them?
That's amazing.
When your parents died, you find the box of teeth. Keep it.
Oh, wow,
would
that's
you be
a
able
good
to
question.
Throw out your own teeth?
I know, that's really
interesting.
I think you'd have to bury them or something.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And then you'd have to return your siblings' teeth to them.
But
you want to keep those.
Oh, my God.
That's funny, isn't it? Not just whether you could throw away someone else's object, whether you could throw away a relic of your own.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a reliquary, isn't it, we're talking about? Wow.
God, that's a very spooky scenario.
Especially as sort of child's tooth as well, that was yours, because it's a thing that you almost can't relate to. It's, that was me as a... Well, the umbilical, if you found that, that would be spooky.
You're damaging your child to be found.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was
not something you want to find.
I asked the woman when I said,
dead and gone, so you'll be like that.
I said, is there anything you can do to defuse them?
I'm going to leave it.
And he said that you can bury them.
Bury them.
But I'd chosen not, he'd chosen not to bury them. Because he thought it was, you know, rather that it was part of what they were. Although somebody else told me something slightly differently, that they do kind of cleansing rituals over them. It just occurred to me that you could bury the umbilical cord or the teeth.
So there
are ways of getting rid of things as well.
But you couldn't put them in the bin.
No,
I don't think so.
And in the same way that you could give your dad's suits to, presumably, if somebody else would wear them.
Oh yeah, that was the idea about giving them to Oxfam, so I knew somebody else would use them and wear them. And I was, and they were not going to go somewhere where they were going to just be shredded, because they were good suits. You know, the rubbish clothes, it doesn't matter, but the good stuff.
Yeah.
And there's a textile museum, I think I'll give one or two that actually is relevant. It's like, yeah, as you say, museums don't want too many, but I know students can use them to see how things used to be made.
Absolutely.
Vintage
suits. Yeah.
Don't think
you'd have problems.
Because
people fall in and out, lovely things like that, don't they?
In and out of love
is also really interesting. This notion of in and out of love is also interesting. And as you say, another generation will give something value.
But that's also interesting. So, say we save an object because we're passionate about the person that we save the object from, and we hold this fabulous object, and then suddenly we find out something, you know, our father was a mass murderer or something, and we changed. What happens to how we feel about that object? Because the object's the object, isn't
it? The object's the same, so it's all about projection.
It's imbued with the same amount of touching and caring and placing and venerating, and suddenly it's, I don't know whether it suddenly becomes something different or...
Depends what it was. If it was an axe, then you'd be, my father's favourite axe.
I don't know why you like that axe, so...
Well, that's interesting.
Because when we save that object, we really do want to feel that there's still that moment, don't we? That's my...
Objects from periods as well, then, especially if it looks like something that's had love and care over the years, and buy a piece of furniture and talk about it, say, oh yeah, this could be our lady's house and she looked after it. And
doesn't that depend though? Because actually, other people's wear can be quite disgusting.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it kind of depends a lot on. I did a lot of work on touch. And there's a lot of stuff about whose touch is seen to pollute and whose is natural. So what counts as dirt is really subjective and who's... So basically, if you've got a very, very good quality sofa, I don't know, somebody famous or a member of the royal family or somebody, you know, and the wear on the arms comes from Marilyn Monroe, you know, that's a hell of a difference between, like, actually some grungy bloke that you never liked. Because actually you wouldn't, you'd have to sell it or you'd have it dipped or, you know, scrub it with bleach. You know, when you get it with valuable objects, that actually certain forms of damage can contribute value because of who.
And culture. Some cultures like bright, shiny things. Some cultures like dark, patinated things.
Is that true?
In Praise of Shadows is a lovely book about the Japanese love of the dark shadow and the patination.
Right. Oh, yes. It's really where.
Exactly. So having something untouched, you know, unclean, darker and darker and darker has seemed to be exactly those things where, you know, we live in a bright, shiny world, don't we? You know, silver polish and...
Yeah. But there's also the difficulty about
decided, culturally conditioned. What is desirable?
But also some things take wear better than others. So all the sort of plastic products that we have now don't wear well, whereas wood or metal, some kinds of metal, wear in a very beautiful way. Plastic just kind of discolours and cracks.
But there are quite a lot of cultures, especially in hot countries,
yeah,
where they have a temple and they decay, so they, you know, they knock up a new wing for that and a new statue for that, and it doesn't matter. It's
yeah, they don't have the same respect for old, which is kind of
no,
for
but
us
the same respect for the object.
It's the
but the object seemed to be in flux.
Yeah, they don't have respect for the object as a historical object. Yeah. They have a respect for the object for its signification.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
And so, yeah, you'll repaint the Buddha, or you might even remake it. And it's like, but it's a, you know, it's a 12th century Buddha. Oh, it doesn't matter. It's got a nice and bright because it's next festival's coming.
So the object is. It's just the thing that fills that very space, isn't it?
Well,
it's allowed to be changed and changed and changed and changed.
I suppose.
Yeah. At the end of the day, that's where we come back to, isn't it?
Oh,
good. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Emily.
Yeah.